No.
the share button. I think we run into this every time
Oh,
lately.
God.
Yeah.
So how do I do that?
Only meeting organizers and presenters can share.
Shoot.
I think if you clicked on the share button, you might be able to change the option.
The share button. No. No.
I wonder if I can request it. I don't think so.
And also in the settings, let's see here. No, it doesn't let me do it either. Let me. Person who set it up is looking into it.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think before we didn't have this problem, but it seems like if there's a way.
Know, and people wanted to have Teams because they said it's easier, but I
I
don't
think it
know.
was as soon as we switched to Teams. This is, I think, when we started running into this every month.
More problems, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Mayo has kind of a restricted Zoom policy because I ran into this last week with another meeting, different issue, but the guy wanted Zoom and it was not easy to get it switched.
Oh, here we go. All right.
Just
I just got access here. You know what? I guess I'll put it up over here. All right. So can you guys see that screen?
yep, we
Yeah,
can.
we
We
click.
can.
Yep. Okay. So the first one here we're going to talk about is one out of, I believe this was Memorial Sloan Kettering. This was a look at this, what they're calling pulmonary solid and granular adenocarcinoma. So I have four for discussion, by the way. I'll just give you a little outline here. This one, which essentially is what some people have called hepatoid for a long time, and that's what they're focusing on there. And then the next one is a new IHC marker for differentiating mesothelioma from some of its mimics, malignant and benign mimics. And then genomic characterization of lung cancer in never smokers, that's using a deep learning model. So we do have one AI paper, as we usually do lately. And then I wanted to finish with something that's just looking at some pictures and is a little easier on the brain than this AI stuff. So just a description of a couple thymomas that are a little bit funny looking. So starting off with this one, what they did was basically over time, I believe they collected 17 different lung tumors that had a hepatoid looking morphology. And they basically described that here as solid or trabecular growth. Usually these were granular and eosinophilic looking. And that's what kind of prompted that type of morphology is what prompted HEPAR1 in the first place. All of these ones that they selected for the main cohort of 17 tumors happened to be HEPAR1 positive. And so they assembled those, they reevaluated with an additional panel of HCC IHC markers, so AFP, arginase, glypican, and albumin-ish. And then a secondary cohort they took was they took acinar predominant lung adenocarcinomas. They made a microarray of 100 something of them through HEPAR1 at all of those, and then selected 22 of those cases that were HEPAR positive to look at more and compare them to things that were exclusively solid and trabecular to try to get at basically are there other types that don't just have a very hepatoid look to them that have any similar features to them. So for these, all the typical pneumocytic markers, mostly TTF1 and NAFS and A, were performed on all of their primary cases. And then mucocarmine was added on as well to look for mucin that might have been hard to identify on H&Es. Many cases also had other IHC performed, as you would imagine, for things like this, CK7, P40, SMARC-A4, and SMARC-A2 were done on a good amount of them. And then they did NGS on all 17 of those cases in their primary cohort. And then they also estimated mitochondrial content by a couple different methods. None of it was direct, but all of it was indirect surrogates to try to get an idea of whether there's more mitochondria in this type than just your other conventional lung adenocarcinomas. So all of those 17 hepatoid cases, so those that primary cohort they looked at, those were robustly positive for HEPAR1, very strong positivity, and completely negative for all the other HCC markers. Morphology here was solid, and I'll pull this up because, of course, seeing is believing for us. All of those had morphology that looked like this. By definition, they had to be solid and or trabecular to some degree. And that's what we're seeing here. Very crisp cell membrane, so really well delineated from each other. And you can see how, you know, HCC would be in the differential here, especially when you have your positive HEPAR1. One of the interesting things I found in here is that a lot of these had mucin that was at least focal. In fact, all of them had at least focal mucin production, which, of course, HCC, conventional HCCs will not make mucin. And here's a breakdown in their primary cohort of what kind of IHC they were seeing. So none of them had TTF1. About a quarter of them had cytoplasmic staining for TTF1, which is a little bit unusual. And then CK7 was reliably positive. They actually had SMARC-A4 loss in half of these. And then mucocarmine staining was at least rare to focal in many of them, but a lot of times it was more in the moderate to diffuse range. As far as growth patterns, all of them by definition had to have solid and granular growth. In terms of a dominant growth pattern, some of them had a background of acinar and cribriform growth as well. And then all of them had to have at least some areas with granular and eosinophilic cytoplasm. Others had more of a vacuolated microvesicular or even clear cell change type features. And of course, those things can be confused with HCCs too. Most had macronucleoli, and then inflammation in the background was pretty common. About a third of them had a lot of neutrophilic stuff mixed in. And here's just an example of some of their staining. Very strongly diffusely positive for HEPAR1. These H scores here, that's just the traditional method of H scores. Almost all their cases were very strong and diffuse. Only a couple of these ones in this primary cohort that they looked at had anything less than the 300 range of an H score. As far as their molecular goes, these were essentially, from a molecular standpoint, pretty high grade, poorly differentiated tumors. All of them had STK11 aberrations of some kind. And that's really the highlight molecular feature here that ties in with the morphology that was very consistent, is that STK11 had some kind of loss of function or deletion in every single one of these 17 cases. 16 of those were by molecular, and then some, they had one more that was by IHC that showed complete loss of staining, because I don't think they had, they might not have had the block at the time of molecular, or I think it might have run out of tissue. And then, as you can see here, so this is their what they're calling SAGA, so solid and granular adenocarcinoma is the name that they're giving to this, rather than hepatoid. So they went with that because they're convinced that this isn't true hepatoid or hepatic differentiation. But these had pretty high rates of KEAP1, which goes along with STK11 a lot of time, but KRAS, TP53, and SMARC-A4 loss. So genetically, they tend to be pretty aggressive, and they're kind of on par with what you would think of as a poorly differentiated solid adenocarcinoma in terms of their aggressiveness. But I think the unique thing here is the morphology that looks very polygonal, trabecular, and solid, and having the HEPAR1 expression. All right. So the, in that parallel cohort, I will say median survival here, and this is getting to the point of this is a poorly differentiated solid adenocarcinoma with aggressive behavior. Median overall survival was much lower in these SAGA cases, those 17 cases that they looked at. And that was true compared to the stage-matched adenocarcinomas that they used from a different larger cohort. Those stage-matched controls were from an older cohort, so it's not a, an exact one-to-one comparison, but the cohort's not that old. So I don't think things have changed too radically since that comparison cohort. Then in their parallel cohort, this secondary cohort where they took acinar predominant lung adenocarcinomas that happened to have HEPAR expression, they had a lot of the same features in there. So they had STK11 mutations in all of those. They had increased granular cytoplasm, lower TTF1 expression, and overall a more poor prognosis. And their data on that looked pretty similar. Here we go. So this is that secondary cohort of acinar predominant ones that were selected out of 22 cases. And you can see that a lot of these have granular and eosinophilic cytoplasm. A lot of them had mucin scattered in, macronucleoli, and they did not have other HCC markers once again. So pretty consistent findings here. So this seems to be something that might be more in a transitional state into that full SAGA morphology. And they kind of make that argument based on this. So take-home messages here, isolated HEPAR1 positivity, especially in a TTF1 negative tumor, that's no nuclear TTF1. Solid lung adenocarcinoma is a strong indicator of STK11 mutation. And what they're calling mitochondrial adaptation, or an increase in mitochondrial quantity, and that's another thing they showed here, rather than a bona fide hepatoid differentiation where you would expect things like arginase and albuminase to be positive. So if you're evaluating these hepatoid looking lung tumors, with you need to use an extended panel basically with multiple HCC markers before deciding on whether you're dealing with this SAGA term. Honestly, I feel like they need to workshop that name a little bit. It's a little boring versus metastatic HCC. These adenocarcinomas, they'll almost always have STK11 mutations seemingly and other aggressive molecular features that really portend an aggressive clinical course and resistance to immunotherapy, which is typical of the STK11 mutant tumors. And then in metastatic tumors of unknown primary, especially if you have a large lung mass, HEPAR1 is not sufficient alone to conclude that you're dealing with something from the liver. So first off, has anyone seen anything that they know fit into this category?
If I have, I probably just called it poorly differentiated adeno.
Right.
And that was, you know, this is my question for it. They compared it with stage, how did you formulate it? The stage equal.
Controls, yeah.
Yeah. But did they compare it with other adenocarcinomas of high grade? I mean,
that's
this
the thing.
Would,
I don't,
because
I don't
of the solid component, it would be the high grade. Pun?
Right. I don't think they specifically said, all right, let's compare these SAGAs to other solid adenocarcinomas that don't have HEPAR1 expression. And that in terms of the survival, it makes it so that it's a little bit of a moot point. It's like we always knew poorly differentiated solid adenocarcinomas were worse. To me, the unique thing about these is that the morphology and the molecular tie together so cleanly in terms of like it's very predictable when they had this morphology with HEPAR1. They always had STK11 mutation, which is, I thought was kind of cool.
I've actually seen a couple of these cases as well, but it was years back, and so I don't think we had molecular on them, but they fit the morphology and the IHC perfectly.
Yeah, I had seen one only because somebody from Neuropath brought me one, something that looked exactly like this. I had initially kind of skimmed through this paper when it first came out a few months ago, and then like 3 days later, just by chance, one of the Neuropath people came by and they're like, they have this large lung mass and it's expressing Hepar and like nothing else. The TCF1 looks really weird because it's cytoplasmic. And I was like, wait a second. And I was like, does it have an STK11 mutation? He's like, I don't know, I'll go check. And then he's like, yeah, it does. It has all these other bad mutations. So I think we had solved that problem like right off the bat for that one. But I haven't seen any other ones since then. But nice tie-in between the morphology and molecular there.
Will, does that molecular profile have anything to do with hepatocellular carcinoma or not at all?
That's a good question. I don't know. I actually have no idea if it relates directly. Like if you have STK11 or not. Yeah. But yeah, they see it more as it becomes hepatoid because of these STK11 mutations driving increased mitochondrial content as a compensatory mechanism for something. Okay, so moving on to this new IHC marker in mesothelioma. So GFPT2 is something that these authors had previously identified that seems to be highly expressed in mesotheliomas, and they wanted to more thoroughly evaluate it against its mimics. So they did an IHC analysis of just this particular marker. They did have other mesothelial markers on a lot of these cases, and we can look at that table, but on 101 mesothelioma, so pretty good size here, a lot of epithelioid, sarcomatoid for me usually tend to be the more tricky ones. They only had 11 of those. Obviously they can be hard to find pure ones, but overall pretty good cohort size. And then they compared it to 266 different morphologic mimics, so pretty good size comparison for an IHC study here. And they included things like non-small cell lung carcinoma, obviously, high-grade serous ovarian carcinoma, EHE, SFT, fibromatosis. So not necessarily like full-on malignancy. Some of these are just locally aggressive tumors, but 6 synovial sarcomas, some liposarcomas, and so on. So things that they definitely did, I think, a pretty good job of covering the differential, especially for spindle cell things here. Would have liked to see more sarcomatoid carcinomas because sarcomatoid carcinoma versus meso can obviously be very tricky sometimes. And then benign comparators that they included were 20 reactive mesothelial hyperplasia cases and 13 well-diff papillary mesothelial tumors. So pretty good size for the benign comparators too. And then they define the threshold as an H score. So that's typical H scoring of, you know, 1, 2, and 3, and then multiplied by the percentage of the tumor that you have. So the highest score, of course, is going to be 300 there. So they put a cutoff of 90, and they set it a little bit higher than was like recommended by the curve just to boost the specificity a little bit and still maintain a pretty good sensitivity. So it was positive in 85% of all of their mesotheliomas and none of their reactive mesothelial hyperplasias or their well-differentiated papillary mesothelial tumors. It was negative in almost every single malignant comparison they had. They had one kind of atypical looking EHE case where this was positive and it was a low positive score. So it was kind of borderline on their on that cutoff of an H score of 90. And then it was some of the aggressive fibromatosis cases had staining for GFPT2, one MPNST, and one sarcomatoid carcinoma. Problem here was that their DDIF liposarcomas had really high expression of this particular marker, which, since we have other tools to work that out, it's not a huge deal. But that is one caveat to this in terms of spindle cell malignancies. So the reported sensitivity here was 85% for mesothelial tumors versus everything else they were comparing it to. And the specificity was 95% about. So here's their table of overall staining sensitivity, basically, in the different types of mesos here. So it was still pretty high across the board, slightly lower maybe in sarcomatoid. And then, yeah, you can see the breakdown of their other stains here. The WT1 was weirdly low, I feel like. And so it is a cytoplasmic stain, cytoplasmic and membranous, but usually it's strong cytoplasmic staining. And for the most part in these tumors, it was very strongly diffusely positive in many of the mesotheliomas. So it should be a pretty easy thing to read in the majority of cases. I think the average H score was about 280 from what they said. So it was pretty high. I hope I'm remembering that right and not getting confused with the last paper. But so they had a pretty good mix of different tumors that were negative here, non-small cells and things like that. And then here are their positivity rates in meso versus our other things that we just went through. And that's actually all I want to show from that one on that side. So this, it seems like it's a promising new marker for mesothelioma. The interesting thing here is that rather than just being a marker of mesothelial differentiation, it seems like it's a marker of mesothelioma specifically, even compared to reactive states of mesothelial cells, which is kind of an interesting new twist on, you know, IHC as far as mesothelioma, because typically we've just had ones for differentiation and then our loss of BAP1, MTAP, kind of our markers of malignancy. And this seems to kind of combine two of those things. So it could potentially be useful. I think it probably does still need a lot of external validation just to see overall, does this pan out in larger sets? Are there any, you know, but benign or reactive conditions that or cases that can be positive. They had a total of 20, which is pretty good. But I'd be worried about overinterpreting just based on 20 cases. New IHC mesothelial stuff in our toolkit again. And it just seems to keep growing a little bit at a time. So that's one to keep an eye on.
So I'm always skeptical with this kind of thing. They say it's both for lineage and cancer, like, because it doesn't look that way. So I checked the gene really quick. It's not a mesothelial lineage specific marker. It's more like a cancer specific, like cancer type of marker, because upregulation of GFPT2 promotes like tumor cell proliferation, migration, tissue invasion, this kind of behavior. So it does report in, like, for example, breast cancers, more aggressive breast cancers will have higher expression of this protein. But I don't see they test any breast cancer here. So I think it may be useful for example, like a MTAP, BAP1 kind of thing, like differentiate between benign and malignant, or lower aggressiveness tumor versus highly aggressive tumor. But I don't think it will be pretty specific in terms of different organ type of thing or lineage type of thing.
That's a good point. The thing they did not test in here was metastatic tumors, which obviously in the pleura is very relevant. So they did a good job of including things that could be, I guess, technically high-grade serous ovarian carcinoma if we're in the pleura. They did include one thing that can metastasize there, but this seems to be, if you think you're dealing with a primary, they did a pretty good job of including malignancies that could be in the differential there. But yeah, it's clearly not restricted to mesothelial proliferations because of this high rate in dedifferentiated liposarcoma. So yeah, it's probably not accurate to think of it as another mesothelial differentiation marker, I should say. That's a good point. It's more of a malignancy marker in this case. It just happens to be negative in a lot of other malignancies that would be in your differential for a primary tumor, seemingly. So one to keep an eye on. Okay. Moving on to our AI paper here. So this is something similar to stuff we've talked about here before. And this kind of work has been done in more broad cohorts where they've looked at smoker dominant cohorts. So just all comers for lung cancer. They specifically looked here in never smokers for basically, can you train a model to predict the likelihood of having a variety of different mutations and other genomic signatures that aren't just point mutations or deletions or things like that? And how well does it do at predicting those just based on H&E alone after you've trained it on things where it knows which mutation or which mutations, plural, some of these tumors might have? So a lot of this terminology for AI papers is lost on me. I have not had any true education in how these convoluted neural networks work. But essentially, they used a customized one that was based on this ResNet 50 architecture. And that seems to be one that was recently popular a few years ago. One of the pieces of the summary here that I had gotten from Claude, and thanks to Matt, if he's on, for sending me a nice first draft made by Claude. It had said this ResNet 50 and some of the other ones that it had mentioned in this paper have been supplanted even within the last few years with newer models. But they optimized their convoluted neural network here for multi-label classification. So it can simultaneously predict the presence of multiple independent molecular aberrations. So if it had EGFR and something else like P53, it would be able to simultaneously look for both of those things, essentially. That's my understanding of it. And that's what the model outputs at the end. It can output however many things it wants to predict are there or are not there. So in terms of training and the evaluation, they went with the Sherlock lung never smoker cohort, which had a good mix of different patient populations from different institutions. They had almost 500 whole slide images from 400 cases, so pretty large cohort. And of course, those cases of the whole slide images get broken down into tons and tons and tons of tiles, and it ends up being 5 million in this case. And that's what this thing is trained on. So essentially, we have a large training set and then a small validation set based within that training set. And then we have this holdout testing set at the end where we see how well the model actually does on stuff it's never seen before. And then they looked at 16 different molecular features to see how well it could estimate or guess, basically predict whether any of these were present. So EGFR, things that would be, most of these would be clinically meaningful, the first list here. Then they get into some other stuff where I'm not sure anyone knows clinically exactly what they should be doing with these, but they included them, I think, to see basically, can this model predict these types of things? So EGFR and KRAS are going to be some of the most important ones here, ALK fusion. And they, for 11 of the features, the area under the curve for being able to predict the presence of a mutation in one of these genes was pretty high. It was pretty impressively high in a lot of these. So things with an AROC, 0.84 and up were EGFR, KRAS, ALK fusions, NPM2 amplification. It can pick out you know, resistance markers in EGFR and targetable mutations in EGFR separately. And then low performance things, it actually wasn't good at deciding whether a tumor mutational burden was high or not. Some of that they think might be because the tumor mutational burden in these never smoker cases tends to be low anyway, so there's not a lot of spread for the model to work with. And then this APOBEC signature, it was not very good at picking out KRAS mutations. It actually didn't have a ton of cases of KRAS mutations to work with, so it didn't get to see a lot of it, and therefore probably wasn't as good at predicting these specific mutations. And it was selecting these out differently. It wasn't just saying, do we have a KRAS mutation of any kind? It was actually looking and taught specifically, this is what a KRAS G12D mutated tumor looks like. This is what a G12C mutated tumor looks like. So it wasn't great at figuring out which of those was which in the end. And this, is essentially how they broke down what they were doing. So they split, they got all their whole slide images, split them into tiles, and then they feed the genomic data together with those tiles. The convoluted neural network, convolutional neural network basically tries to decide after being taught essentially, or teaching itself, what makes something morphologically, what makes something an EGFR positive tumor or a TP53 mutant tumor. And then you test all those on your holdout validation set of things that it's never seen before. And these are how their curves break down. So these are the ones that it was quite good at predicting your EGFRs, KRAS, or not KRAS, excuse me, P53, and RMB10 and things like that. So, and then their heat maps are kind of interesting because they show you just how, well, they, first of all, as you would expect, something that's clonal, it's the entire tumor is red. That's saying this is a very, very, very high probability that this is, has this specific EGFR mutation here. It's a little bit less sure here, seemingly, about a TP53 mutation, and then there's RBM10 as well that it called positive. But it did call all of these positive, and it called all of these negative. So they think, basically, at the end of the day, the idea here is that this would be for screening cases initially and triaging things. I'm not sure how it would change things. I'm not sure if anybody start therapy based on this while waiting for molecular testing. I don't know if regulation wise that would be approved or not. But they seem to think it could be useful for triaging which tissue gets used for molecular too. But I don't know if anyone else familiar with this knows what the ultimate goal of these types of studies are. They're interesting for tying together morphology and molecular, because they can, obviously these kind of things can see things in a way that the human eye can't. But they do share some of their heat maps online, and you can see, you know, what their different tumors look like, what areas they predict have certain mutations, and to what degree the model is certain. So they share all of that online, or not all of it, but they share at least a subset of it online, and you can look at their heat maps for it. It's kind of interesting.
Again, it's me. I'm a molecular pathologist, so I want to keep my job, so I don't like those algorithms. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah.
But I think not, those...
yeah, they can't replace it yet. That's for sure.
I think those algorithms, I see them in, like, as they say, like, two kind of things. One is more like screening, and then the other is for, like, if the tissue is really limited and you have, like, only not much tissue can do the large panel, like, what can you do to screen it to see, like, which gene to target to do a single gene or something in those, like, difficult situations. But the caveat is they all train on the whole slide imaging on the resection. So yeah. I don't know how good they will perform on the small biopsy, which you only have like 200 cells to do one test. So yeah. I think that's the limitation, that they are good, but they may not be useful in the real world for that situation. The other claim is they can like screen for like resource poor areas in the world, that they can just do targeted based on that, possible to decrease the sequencing cost. But I don't know how expensive the drug there is for
right.
in those that resource really limited rural areas in the rural part of the world. Yeah,
if access to the testing is difficult, then access to the drug is probably going to be difficult too. But yeah, external, I even say here, external validation on smaller biopsies, and then evaluation in a turnaround time driven workflow, you'd have to do a lot more work to get this to be ready for actual practice here. All right, and just a couple minutes left.
Hey, Will, thanks for exposing us to these kind of studies. I think since they are coming out more and more, it's really important to talk about these studies. And I think the principle is actually, I really like it, that you can predict based on morphology, even if you use AI, certain mutations. I mean, the other application I could imagine is if you have, for instance, the EGFR mutation-specific antibodies, and you know that this predicts an EGFR mutation, you could just do the IHC and be done in 1 or 2 days instead of waiting for like 3 weeks for the NGS results. So I would see some value here. I don't know how much material they need. They don't need any additional material for that. So that would be an application.
Yeah. And if you got, theoretically, if you got the sensitivity for certain things high enough, you may be able to skip certain types of testing or delay them and put them, on the back burner while you do other things. So the stuff is interesting. It's not going away. There's going to be more and more of these types of studies, I think, coming out. Some of these algorithms are getting terrifyingly good at this stuff. So last one here. This one's going to be pretty quick. This is just a pretty basic description of 7 different cases of what they're calling a morphologic variant of WHO type A spindle, just a your typical spindle cell thymoma, with areas of solid growth, as we expect in these, and then cystic changes, and then focal mucinous differentiation. And that's the thing that makes it different, because I think we all see, cystic type A thymomas probably with a decent amount of regularity. I don't notice mucinous cells that often in them, or things with glandular differentiation. So they had 7 cases here, 5 men, 2 women, average age of 50, all mediastinal masses, not any different clinically or radiologically from any other type of thymoma. All of these were well circumscribed, some were, around 2.5 to 5 centimeters. Most were pretty much encapsulated, not much invasion. One had a little bit of minimal invasion outside of the capsule. So again, plus mucinous differentiation is the thing that differentiates it from just a typical spindle cell thymoma that happens to have some cystic change in the background. So the same pair here from MD Anderson describes in a pretty similar seeming set of cases back in 2013, where I think they said they called it with glandular differentiation or something like that. In this case, what they're arguing is different is this triphasic morphology. So your solid component, your cystic component, and then areas of mucinous differentiation. I don't know how different these actually are from the ones with a little bit of glandular structures included that they described 13 years ago. They seem to be pretty similar looking altogether. But it's just, it's nice to be aware of the fact that you can have these spindle cell or these mucinous cell components in there, that it can be variably positive for CK7, CK20, CDX2, some things we associate with the GI tract in mucinous cell type neoplasm. So taking a look at some of these. So yeah, the top two pictures up here look, you know, similar to a type A thymoma that happens to have some cystic change to it. The unique thing about these is the glandular structures with mucinous cells admixed that don't need to be confused for, worst case scenario, confused for metastatic tumor inside of a thymoma, or things like mucoepidermoid carcinoma, adenocarcinoma arising in the thymus. Of course, on a core biopsy of something like this, it could get a lot more challenging, right? If you only have the glandular components with very minimal background spindle cell component. So nice cluster of goblet cells, admixed mucinous cells in there. They are going to be mucocarmine positive. And here are their CK7, CK20, and CDX2 staining. So those can have some, they don't actually go into detail how many of them had CK20 or CDX2, but they said a subset of the cases did. So that one was just a quick one I wanted to end with, just to remind people that you can have a little bit of glandular differentiation in type A thymomas. And they don't seem to be any different from a clinical or radiologic standpoint. They seem to be very similar to other type A thymomas. Something that I haven't seen, I don't think, in a resected type A thymoma yet. All right, and then for notation, there are a lot of very clinically relevant papers. A lot of big clinical trial data came out, seemingly including stuff for HER2. And HER2 in the first line setting as well for lung adenocarcinoma with HER2 mutations. So that's newer in terms of the fact that this particular drug here is going to be considered for first line. So non-neoplastic, not a ton. There's an editorial that's kind of cute, maybe worth reading, about just the importance of, where is that thing? The importance of early biopsy and early tissue sampling in ILD, which, and cryobiopsy specifically, here we go, tissue-based categorization of fibrotic interstitial pneumonias, when early diagnosis can make. Of course, early diagnosis on a cryobiopsy, depending on what you get, can be very tough. So just an interesting editorial about the way pulmonologists are thinking about what we're capable of on certain biopsies. But really it's focused on UIP versus not UIP. So, all right. And that's all I've got.
Thanks, Will, for doing it under circumstances.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Yep. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.